ever contemplating expanding the firm or moving into other markets?
No. I like to think that we had enough sense to realize we were doing all right, thank you, and that the cobbler should stick to his last, which I happen to hold that view still, unless you're something exceptional. You know, and of course, a lot of the time, the taxation was so high, it sounds ridiculous, that it wasn't worth making any money when we had to pay 90% out. That went on, and then it got lower, of course. So the answer is no, we thought we were all right as it were.
Were you conscious, though, as we come to the 1960s, of the number of jobbing firms decreasing, of firms yes. like Weird and Aykroyd getting involved in these big mergers?
Yes. But it didn't worry us, because we thought, this may sound big-headed, that we were quite all right. And I think, I'm getting a bit carried away, but I think we realised that we had the best reputation in the whole stock exchange of any jobber.
Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, I think, I'm not suggesting other jobbers were dishonest in that sense, although there were some who were, but I think they came to us because they knew we were 120% honest. And Alec Hill in particular, who was quite a big sort of shot in this city in his own way, captain of the Royal and Ancient Golf Club. This is part of the club they talk about in the stock exchange, you see. If you're, you know, captain of the R&A, if you're captain of Middlesex cricket, you've got a sort of cachet, don't ask me. It's the way of, or was the way of the world. So, and Alec was pretty influential around the place, and when people wanted to know something, they'd come around to us more than other people. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's nothing wrong with other jobs. I just think that, I mean, Jimmy Priestley couldn't have been better, more popular, for example. Mm-hmm. But we had something that other people hadn't got, and I think they thought, which is quite right, that we basically had no axe to grind. We weren't trying to get on the council, we weren't trying to be chairman. I'm not suggesting Priestley was for one moment, don't get me wrong. I just think we had that reputation, and we were completely fearless, if that's the right word, of upsetting anybody. Most stock jobbers are frightened of upsetting a broker because he may lose his business. We were so strong in our own market, I'm sorry to show off, but we were so strong in our own market, we could do what we liked, and we bloody well did do, and told people off, and refused to deal with them. And that all added up to our reputation. I don't know what else.
Are there any particular examples you can give of those situations, perhaps not necessarily going into names
I mean, I could give you an example. I don't know whether this is very relevant, but a long time ago now, some tobacco company were buying up Gallagher's. I think it's that way around. It may have been Gallagher's buying the other way around, but we didn't deal in the stock. And the price was 34.9. It's funny how I remember figures. And the arrangement was that the brokers who were doing the business for the buyer, it was quite open and above board, were giving 34.9, and I think there were two brokers doing the business for the buyer, and the jobbers would get 34.8 farthing. And this was going very nicely. We didn't deal in the tobacco market, and it was getting on. And Kasnov, somebody in Kasnov, I don't really want this repeated outside this room, although I don't mind. It doesn't really matter.
Turn off the tape then.
No, no, it's all right. I don't mind. No, I don't mind. Because it doesn't really matter. It's true, so it doesn't matter. Kasnov bid 34 and ninepence to the dealers outside and cut out the jobber. You see, it was to get the business because the chap outside got 3 farthings more. And this eventually caused trouble. And you see, it's nothing the Stock Exchange rules which said they couldn't do it. It was just ungentlemanly conduct, or Section 45 of the Army Act, which you've never heard of, is conduct, detrimental to the Her Majesty's forces or something like that. Well, now, I wrote a letter to the Stock Exchange Council and sent a copy to Kasnov and said, I thought this was disgraceful, it was very bad for the Stock Exchange, the name of the Stock Exchange, etc., etc., and Kasnov should be ashamed of themselves or words of this effect. And the next morning, the chairman of the Stock Exchange and 10 other different members of the council came down and said, well done, Dick, but you're a bloody fool. Why am I a bloody fool? Well, Kasnov are never going to deal with you again. And you've lost their business. I said, we'll see. When you tell the truth, you come time. Anyway, but well done, the chairman said, and well done, but this is what we want. Somebody, because I said, we don't deal in the market, it hasn't affected our pockets, but it's the name of the story, it seems. Well, about an hour later, the senior partner of Kasnov is now dead, Sir Anthony Hormey, came over, red in the face. Dick, he said, what, this letter, bloody disgraceful. I said, no, I'm not disgraceful, Andy. You're the disgraceful man. Your firm has behaved. I said, you're meant to the Rolls Royce of the Stock Exchange, behaving like this. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. Not me. He said, oh, perhaps, what am I going to do? Just like that. I said, go upstairs and say you've made a balls of it and you're very sorry and hope you may be censured because the whole Stock Exchange knows about it, but nobody's going to be something that. Goes upstairs and says he's very sorry and I think they put a notice on the Stock Exchange. But that is why George Hill, and of course we got more business of Kasnov, not less. But that was the attitude of 10 members, 10 or 12 members came down and said, you're going to lose your business. So that's why George M. Hill and Company did stand up and everybody knew it. And I think it did us a lot of good. Well, I know it did a lot of good, and Kasnov never went anywhere else, I mean.
What was happening to the other jobbers in your market? Were they beginning to
thin out? They were, some of them were getting too old. And the turnover dropped, and I think largely most of them were getting too old, and they were unable. They didn't get on anybody who was any good. In the end, when we eventually merged with WED, later date, I think I'm right in saying there were only three jobbers left.
Can you remember who they were?
Pulley was still there, and Smith Brothers came into the market when they saw a bit of money around the place. You know, I don't blame them, but them, their Smith Brothers opportunities cost them a fortune still. Pulley and Smith Brothers were there, who came later. And H.G.M. Smith, they stayed. Parmenter had gone. Mitchell stayed. I think Mitchell stayed till about 1970. But he became a one-man firm, or two-man firm. He couldn't have a one-man firm. Farman had gone, Rudd had gone, Edgerton had gone. There's another firm, C.S. Williamson, they went. They went a long time ago. So I think there were only about three left at the end of that
day. Was the business itself changing? Were bargains getting any bigger? Were the investors changing?
Well, the bargains got a bit bigger, but I mean, the facts of life are we wouldn't do it, you see. We made out, you see, this that's going on now. That everyone is trying to outdo the next one, and we'll make a prize of 100,000. They've stopped it now, because they lost that much. We'll make, if BZW are making a prize of 100,000, we, Warburg, will make a prize of 150,000, Smith Brothers, 200,000. And of course, it's bloody bonkers. They're all paying the bill. Hence, Cable losing £7 billion, trying to be too big. The bargains were getting bigger, but then we were getting a bit bigger. But then you see, I don't know how much you know about jobbing, but you see, what would happen? Somebody wanted to buy 25,000 Mount Isa. Now, I mean, I don't know who deal with it. Maybe, probably not a very good example in Mount Isa, because I think that market's done this, but he would come to, hopefully to George Hill, most he would, not always, of course, go to Pulley or something out and say, what's the price of Mount Isa? You'd say, 72 shillings to 72 and sixpence. I'm sorry about talking in this language, but I'm talking about the days when it was that. 72 shillings a six, which was quite a close price. How am I going to deal in? 5,000. I want to deal in more than that. Well, if it's 10,000, we'll make you threepence outside it, because you weren't meant to try and find out whether Breger wanted to buy or sell. You realise that? I mean, that was not very honest. So you made a price. Or you'd say to him, if you don't mind me opening you, that's to say, if you want to tell me what you want to do, I'll make a price one way, and I'll wide it one way. So sometimes he didn't mind, sometimes he did. So eventually he said, well, but I want to do in 25,000. Sorry, can't make a price in 25,000. It's all right. I'll make you a price in 12,500, and you leave me the other 12,500 for an hour, or 2 hours, or the rest of the day. Fine. Well, that gave me a chance to go around the place and bid a few people if he was a buyer, and maybe go to another job and buy a few from him. But now, you see, they're all, oh, that's 25, that's nothing, 20, of course, quarter of a million, that's all right.
Would you have ever contemplated going joint book with another firm to handle a particularly large order?
I'd say no. I think, I mean, it sounds rather a big start, but I think we were too big for that. I think people might have come to us, Caitlin, and said, but we didn't. We never really didn't have to take a position like you'd seem to have to now. We just told the broker, sorry. Or we'd say to the broker in 25,000 man, either fine, we'll stick to 5,000 and go around the market and see whether you can deal with the other job with them. They did that sometimes. Sometimes it's success, sometimes without success. They varied a lot, you see.
Now, again, as I asked you earlier, were there particular brokers who specialised in the type of stocks in which you were dealing.
Yeah, but most of those brokers had connections either with what I call a shop or connections with, say, Australia or with, say, South Africa. I mean, one big dealer in Australia who would have done you a bit of good, so to speak, in the nicest possible way was Kit Kat. They did a lot of business in Australia. And, you know, if you wanted to be an Australian mind, I would have said go to Kit Kat, or Gavette did quite a lot. Kit Kat was one, but Casnov did a bit, but they weren't all that big in Australia as Kit Kat was. And D.A. Bevan did quite a lot. I mean, there were quite a few brokers who did. And then, of course, there was another firm called Morton Brothers, but they were arbitrage brokers as opposed to arbitrage jobbers, which you don't know. But I wouldn't have gone to them if I'd been a private client. I wouldn't have put them on the Morton. They're more interested in making their own money. See what I mean?
Well, the shop's very important
in the Australian market, we didn't have much of a shop. Goldfield, I was told, they had a few interests in Australia, and they helped. But helped us. They used to deal with us Luna was one of theirs, which went up the pole, but Lakeview and Star, one or two things like that. But we didn't have the shops like they had in the Kaffir market. You see, a Kaffir market, don't forget, there was Johnny's, as they call them, Johannesburg Investment, General Mining was a shop, Consolidated Goldfields was a shop, so they had an Anglo-American shop, especially in Anglo, were very interested in the copper market. So they had their shop. We didn't have that in the Australian market. I don't think there's ever been a big mining house owning a lot of stocks in the Australian market that I can think of.
Now, by the 60s, the minerals boom in Australia was beginning to take off. Yeah. Did that influence your business?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, that began to go out like this. A lot more money was needed, and, the whole thing changed, you see, because we had two booms. We had the Western mining boom. I remember that Western mining went from... They weren't called Western Mining in the very, very early stages. They were called Gold Exploration. And they were about 70 and sixpence. And then I think they got to about 30 shillings. I can't remember now whether they changed their name or they became Western Mining. And then come about 30 shillings, one began to realize that something big was happening in the nickel. And of course they went from 30 shillings to, at one stage they hit the equivalent of 40 quid, which is a fairly hefty rise. And of course the whole business expanded, and of course they one thing attracted another, you see, because what else can we buy? Because, Western Mining had gone up from £6 to £8 this last week, and we wondered there must be something else. Of course, all the clever buggers out in Australia found something which didn't exist. There were, one or two never really got off the ground.
People were sometimes criticised for over speculation in these mining stocks, that you'd get a sudden boom and then a sudden collapse. Well, did this affect your business in any way?
Oh, yes, Christ. Mm. Good God, yes. I mean, we're traders. Mm. I mean, you were dealing in thousands, tens of thousands of things, oil search, I can't remember more, all sorts of bloody things. I mean, and then, of course, they started saying that North Kalgoorlie had got nickel. They had to be quite near Western Mining, so they went from pound to about £5 or something. And then I can remember to this day, we bought once about somebody died, and we bought, I think it was a quarter of a million Hampton areas at, I think it was tuppence three farthings. I think we eventually sold them at threepence, pay a nice profit percentage. Well, they went to £6 and tuppence three farthings. Mm. Well, I don't know what they are today. I think they're probably about a pound. They did have an interest in nickel, but not that big. But it just expanded right, left, and centre. One thing leads to another. And then you see, and then as I said, if they can't buy Western Mine, they want to buy something else. So you can't stop anybody speculating. But of course, unfortunately, there were people out in Australia who were bloody crooks, really crooks.
What did you think about a lot of the stocks in which you were dealing? Or it didn't matter to you, they were simply apples and pears?
Well, we dealt in what was quoted in, if a stock was quoted on the Australian Stock Exchange, we would deal in it. If people asked us what we thought about it, we'd have to sometimes say, I don't know, because we didn't know. But that's another reason we're going to Australia. Because you found, I went to see the chairman of Mount Isa once upon a time and asked him about somebody whose name I can't remember now. And he said, well, I don't know, Dick. He said, he either ought to have been a lunatic asylum or prison. Well, that gave me all the message I wanted to know. I knew that that bloody thing was useless. It was. And he said he got a whole mountain of copper. And all he had to do was to dig the mountain away everybody, I can't remember the name it was, but they went about £5. I heard this is the chap who ought to have been in prison or on lunatic asylum. And he had a little tiny sort of hole in the ground, there was some copper coming, and he used to send about 400 tons of copper ore, not the copper, to Mount Isa to be treated, and that's all it was. But then he was carrying on as if he'd got one new, so one came back to London and told everybody that you knew, get out. Some did, some didn't.
Were you regarded as a source of information on a lot of these mining stocks?
Yeah.
Would people approach you outside of the house as well as
very seldom. Near the golf club, they would do. But other reporters used to come round, of course. Reporters would ring up or come round and all that sort of thing. And that's why I got on television, of course, because of... Was the boom going to finish? I was going on television. I had to get the chairman of the Stock Exchange, and I said, I'm going on television tonight with your permission. He said, well, that's all right. What are you going to say? I said, I don't know. They won't tell me what they're going to ask me, but I can guess. I said, I should just tell them the truth as I see it, Martin. And I should make it quite clear it's my own opinion. And I think Poseidon at that moment of time went £90 a share. Well, of course, I had to tell my fellow jobbers I was going on television. And they all read it incorrectly. And the bloody market went down about 5% in London because our Davy was going on television. It's a big drop. And the Evening Standard wasn't, but they thought it was very bad. They said, I bet he's a bear. Well, I don't think we were a bear, bull or a bear particularly. But anyway, I was very careful what I said, and the market went back next morning because I didn't say what they thought I was going to say. So, I mean, I did have, like I said myself, quite a, what's the word? People listened to what I had to say. And I must confess, I was usually right, because I knew what I was saying, having been to the place. I mean, I told them to bloody well sell Poseidon. I mean, nobody listened, but that's neither here nor there.
Was there much pressure on you as a firm to get together with other firms? Did you have approaches from other firms being made to you?
Oh, yes, we were on the pig's back. I mean, we had an approach from... Well, Wed de Lacker was the final one, but we had an approach from Berger, who went broke eventually. They weren't our opposition in. They were in another mining market. I can't remember. They were in the diamond market, and they were in the greyhound market, and I think they were in the Kaffir market, and they approached us. Our accountant says, well, you ought to go 60-40 in your favour, and they suggested 60-40 in their favour, so we didn't stay with them very long. And then Aykroyd were interested. I never went to Aykroyd, and we eventually went to Wed de Lacker.
Now, what were the circumstances? You said earlier that you never contemplated expanding the firm because you felt that you were quite successful and that you were the best jobber in your market.
Yeah.
What caused you to contemplate merging
with? It was caused by people coming to us and asking us to whether we were prepared to join them. And with Berger, we listened because they were a fairly small firm, but the whole thing was Alec Hill had retired. I, by this time, was getting on. I can't remember now how old I was. I suppose I was about 60. And a jobber, in my view, should pack up active dealing probably at 55, certainly 60. He hasn't got the... He's lost the what's needed to be a jobber. He's all right to sit there as a senior partner, but not be an active trader. Do a bit. So I got to that age. The younger generation, the firm, were getting, I don't know what was the matter with them, actually. Two or three of them weren't very good anyway, and they'd made a lot of money, and I think they were going for safety. I didn't think, quite frankly, I didn't have the bloody moral fibre to carry on the firm as it then was, and they thought they were going to get with Big Brother. That's what I really think. And I really couldn't stop it, because I could have stopped it, but it wasn't fair to stop it, because I was going to retire at some stage, and not then. Basically, it wasn't because, it was no way because we wanted to get bigger per se. We were quite happy as we were. But as it turns out, I think it's probably right, because the Australian market has gone up the pole. But at the same time, one doesn't know if George Emmett and Company had gone on dealing in the Australian market, whether the Australian market would have gone up the pole as it, in the same way it has done, because I think it's the chicken and the egg. If people can't deal, they won't deal. Dealing became more and more impossible, so people don't deal. Well, if George Emmett had gone on, I don't know. Probably it would have packed up.
Mm. Did you continue jobbing when the merger took place?
I didn't know. No, I was too old. But I was a kind of eminence grise, I suppose you could say. I still went to Australia several times after we'd merged, and I still kept an eye on the general situation. And, you know, when I just told you, you know, when that chap had a bear of 50,000 mad eyes, I saw the books and did something. I was, you know, sort of overseer, you might say.
How did you find suddenly being part of this very big firm that covered a whole range of markets? Did you find that as jobbers, they were different, they had a different outlook?
Well, I thought it was too big, merely because, I'm not saying I was right, but I thought they were too big, because it was very difficult for them to keep control on the whole organization. You see, they dealt, I think I'm right in saying that Wed Durlach had dealt in 7,000 different stocks. Well, there's nowhere in the world anybody deal. I mean, they don't have 7,000 stocks on most stocks. I mean, I've been to about 20 different stock exchanges all around the world, and I don't think even Tokyo has 7,000 stocks. Admittedly, some of them only change hands once a month, but there's still a stock and there's still money involved and that sort of thing. And I don't think, and I think it was too big and too much dead wood. That's what I thought. And it's very difficult to, because I spoke to Esmond, the great Esmond Erlach, who was the one who brought them all together years ago and saw the future quite rightly. And I said, Esmond, I think you're having too much dead wood, aren't you? He said, well, I don't know about that. I said, well, why is it that those people over there, just pointing, are dissatisfied that they're not, haven't got as big a percentage as those people over there losing a lot of money? I said, this is one of your problems. How do you know, boy? He used to call me boy. How do you know, boy? I said, well, I don't know. I put two and two together. Well, you're dead right, he said. But that was one of the troubles. Well, they're so big, you see, and those get 2% or something, which is 2% of a few million is quite a lot. And those people are getting 3%, and they're losing money hand over fist, and these people are making a fortune. They get furious. So that you've got to put them right. And that's just one of the little things. And the thing is that the dead wood is people who don't make any bloody money. And I think Wed de Laca had probably 30% dead wood, when 15's about the right. You've got to have dead wood full stop, whether it's a civil service or a bloody shop. You cannot be 100%, whatever you do. But 15% is about what I thought. I had 50. He said, what do you know? He said, you've only got 60.